Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified, the number one cybersecurity podcast with your host, Eric Taylor, Shiva Maharaj. Today, we have Matt Lee and Gerald Osher. Didn't butcher it this time.
Yes. Good job.
What's up, boys? Today, we're talking about Reval and Ukraine. Who wants to go first?
Well, I guess I'll stem this thing up. So over over the weekend and on Friday, there was a lot of information that was coming out about Reval. Folks were getting arrested. There was several videos online, if you want to go search it out yourself, where there you can actually watch them actually raid some of the folks. But they were it's now been confirmed that it was on 25 residents and by 14 members, where there was a lot of speculation on how many different locations and how many different people were actually arrested and, taken into custody. Some of the videos were showing, that there was actual US dollars in Russia, which is a little weird that you'd have Russian cash, but I guess, whatever.
All there was the same way, man.
This is true. So it's very, very interesting, of course. Our favorite thing that we like to trash on from me and Shiva is Kaseya. The Reval gang went after those folks. And, even on this video here that we'll have source here, you can actually watch the raid on there. That's the first topic to go on before we really go in. So in my InfoSec world, I'm not sure how true it is, but there's a lot of speculation that the folks that were arrested were a quote unquote pony show. And the reason I say that is apparently the folks that were arrested are low level folks. They were the grunts. They were, the field workers, if you will. These were not the high level executive people of the ransomware organization. I don't know how true that is or not. Time will tell, but it'd be interesting to see.
To jump in here, even if it wasn't, right? We've never heard of any political system turn completely on someone that might have been a shadow ally before, right? The CIA has never done that before and burned an asset. Never. It's not possible. So I think it's irrelevant which side of that is. But let's look at what set the stage here, right? We have ransomware gangs and threat actors that have, existed out of your former, Russia and other models, dark side, similar concept, right? And so you have this immense pressure as we're starting as an economy and as a country to wake up to this risk, right? Like when you saw Americans putting gasoline in a trash bag, it was going to hit presidential level. It was going to start getting talked about. Pressure was going to start existing, right? And so as you start seeing that, the first pressure is this immense Western pressure on Russia to give some tchotchke, right? And so I think that you do have this, basically we can burn this asset. It's worth it for us from a political perspective. It's worth it for us to have this. But at the same time, you have basically mobilized assets, similar to NotPetya and other methodologies in the past against Ukraine. Like Ukraine's always been this giant punching bag. It's almost like Russia's like, hey, we got this for you. I'm not punching my sister, right? Like, and so you have this massive kind of campaign going on at the same time. I feel like it was a bit of sleight of hand and well-timed kind of PR, but I don't know that this means anything. I think that the systemic methodologies of using online presence, social manipulation, right? Putting out a lot of bad data through social media platforms is still a very effective strategy. It's just going to be the next person, Gerald, love to hear your thoughts on it, but that's just my musings.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things going on here, right? So geopolitically, if you look at what is going on in Ukraine and Russia, right? And it's been going on for several years now, but like just in the last 72 hours, there's at least it's being reported, 100,000 troops have amassed, Russian troops amassed on the border. And there's been this basically attack on 70 different Ukrainian government agencies, right? Through a different couple of ways. And it was a supply chain attack, which
and an unknown way right now, right? Like according to Microsoft yesterday, we still don't know the delivery mechanism, just what we found essentially, right?
Right. Well, it's being reported that it was a supply chain attack akin to SolarWinds. They don't know anything other than that. But my point is that is, again, with Russia did this in 14 when they shut the power off in Ukraine. They've done it several times. And it's interesting because Reval, which, you know, some of the code in the Reval ransomware, it looks like dark sites. So this is what Colonial Pipeline, which raised up into US interest.
Yep.
It's interesting to me the timing that Russia would go out and get Reval almost as a, I don't want to call it a token of good faith, but like,
yeah.
Like just don't look,
it,
yeah. Don't look at what we're doing to Ukraine over here, because yeah. We're good guys too. We're knocking out one of these basically APT cyber criminal organizations, and I find that that conflict, it's almost like is that the approach? Because I've always been of this mindset that a lot of these more advanced cyber criminal organizations, especially in the ransomware area, have been operating out of Eastern Europe under almost, I don't want to call it protection, but like if you don't ransomware Russian.
No. Hold on. You're not wrong. A, the Cyrillic keyboards that turn off most ransomware, but let's go all the way back to TrickBot with Silas, right? Silas at one point made TrickBot something that had to be serialized, right? At some point he went from this open source TrickBot methodology. Was it TrickBot? Sorry. No, hold on. It was the botnet. Damn it. Crap. You guys will know it as soon as I say it, but Silas was this Russian human that initially had just open sourced this. Yes, sir. It was the one with the big...
The guy where he registered the domain and shut it down?
No, this is Silas. Was which botnet was this? It wasn't Mirai. Maybe it was TrickBot. No, it was a banking malware. Anyway, right, it doesn't matter. It was the one where basically the FBI ended up getting into their chat servers. And was able to decode the Ukrainian slang, essentially, that's basically said,
looks like.
Was it Mirai? Okay.
Looks like it.
Whichever botnet it was, he operated it. This was an early, early one. He operated it, and it was so good that it was able to, this was a guy who was able to predict the wire transfer schedules, was one of the early ones using the wire methodologies of egress from banking. And they ended up releasing like 50 CFOs from FBI, from being under either investigation or actively had been prosecuted because they were so good at hiding their tracks from that. Right. And so this first guy, but at some point, going back to my initial point, I just got derailed like crazy, but my brain's broken, but at some point he took it back and made it a registered piece, and they started egressing files, and they became essentially an extension of FSB's capabilities from a gathering of intel and espionage capability, right? So we'll let you ransomware. Go ahead and take this data as well. We'll let you do your banking Trojan. Go ahead and take this data. And so they had to control access to the stuff so they could start doing it. My point is there's like a long history of the Russian government being involved in using the extensibility of kind of quote unquote protected, as you said, Gerald, all the way back to your point, and then I'll let you have it. There's a long history of them doing those exact same things of giving protectionism for the name of state and for the name of
ransomware is essentially the cyber warfare version of the Wagner Group out of Russia. And for those who don't know, Wagner Group is essentially a private military that works on behalf of supposedly the Russian state, but the interesting thing about going after the people from Reval, a group that's been defunct for months right now, allegedly, and also the fact that it's basically, hey, if you guys don't spank us for going into the Ukraine, this is how we can reciprocate and go after ransomware for you.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. I don't think it's much of anything other than that. But one thing, and we all see the same news feeds here, right? Everyone's going off and saying, hey, we got Reval. Can we establish the fact that because Reval has been gotten, so to speak, in air quotes, ransomware is not dead?
Oh, yeah. Ransomware is definitely not dead. I mean, just because some of the members of Reval have been scooped up, there's still 13, 14 other, ransomware affiliate groups that are still out there, right? So the fact that, everybody wants to have a sigh of relief, like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about ransomware. Strap up, because like I said, we're at least in the InfoSec community, the ones that I follow, they are very, very alarmed. If what they say is true, that these are some of the low level folks, then, it's just going to take time for them to regroup and come back. Right. So, just going to be interesting. So I do know over the weekend, we've seen Lockbit 2.0 and Conti really ramp up their efforts. And So they are definitely filling the void that's been left by Reevil at the moment.
I read that Conti actually added a slew of new victims to their new site. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, is that because Conti loaded up their new site on January 15th, which was Saturday, does not mean that those are necessarily new victims as of that week, because one of them was Shutterfly, which was announced sometime in December.
Yeah.
If I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
So.
I actually, you know, you just blew my mind. I hadn't actually heard that Conti had brought their page back up.
Yeah.
This week.
Yeah, they've been back for a while.
Conti is back. Lockbit is back. You know, all the big boys are back, but I don't think that has anything to do with Reevil getting shut down in this iteration of their shutdown. Right. Ransomware groups to me have always been incredibly dynamic. They go out, they get their kill, they come home, they review their TTPs where they need to improve, they take time off, they improve those TTPs, and they go back out. Mm-hmm. I wish our industry would do the same thing. I was watching Jerry's webcast this morning on YouTube, Simply Cyber YouTube channel, and there's a guy in Florida who said, unplug everything and let them bitch and complain. Dude, that's been my mantra since Eric has known me. I told that to Matt, and Matt's like, God bless you for being able to do that, but that's what you got to do, man.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, I think, and Matt, maybe you can agree with me or tell me where I'm going askew in this, is in managed services, it should be a my way or the highway if you want the full protection.
It's not that new. I mean, it's more nuanced than that. I agree with the overall statement, right? Like, I think the challenge you have is that as an entire populace, and much like the Industrial Revolution, you've heard me say this talk track before, we have an entire populace that doesn't understand that there are things they must do to protect themselves. They don't understand and accept the risk. There's a, I'll let the smart guy handle it. And then when the smart guy or gal comes back and says, we need budget for this, or we need fundamentally change, unless they can get good enough at the language of business operations and good enough at the language of saying, here's the business reason we should do this going forward, and here's how we support business objectives, then it just doesn't get done. And even when it gets done, it gets pulled apart by executives and people. And short story is, like, we're still in the infant stages of understanding our challenge and risk. If you look at the software vendors, if you look at the consumers, if you look at that, but short story is, yes, if we could somehow make it to where if you're doing technology, you must meet minimum standards. If you're touching things, you must have security as part of the conversation, right? Like, if we could do that, it would be great. But if you went my way or the highway, you would have a scalability challenge in a lot of cases, but you'd have a very protected and defensible position, right? In my opinion, Shiva, I think, you know.
When my managed services side,
yeah,
when they hire me, it's a plan or a subscription they get, not unlike a Microsoft 365 subscription, right?
Sure.
Get all of this in there, we're going to implement it. We're going to
evolve,
make everything, have everything updated as it needs to be. And we never have to come back to you for budget because you're paying fixed price. So that takes a lot of that very constraint out of it after the contract has been signed and paid for.
It does, but the challenges are often things like line of business applications, things that they have to actually change their company because this LOB is only on-prem and it only runs on this and it doesn't have that. And now they have to say, you know what? I've got to change ERPs. I'm going to change every factory touch. I'm going to have to change. Like, you start getting into these things where there's always some compromise. Now, I do agree having some baseline. Like, when I first was in MSP in 2011, we said, I'm going to have the firewall. I'm going to have the antivirus. I'm going to have the dark web monitoring as that came on. We did do exactly what you're saying. We had some minimum standards, but, you know, I think the bulk of risk is those, you know, LOB positions, right? I say this, if you close your eyes and dream and started a company tomorrow, do you have a server? Do you have infrastructure? Do you have these things? Unless you have some major reason you are, you're probably going to start up with some IAM provider, whether that's Okta or Microsoft or AWS or Google. And then you're going to extend that out into all SaaS applications, one of 30 or 40 main applications, right? Whatever it is, it's going to be, yeah. And so ultimately in that world, I could design a very monolithic protection methodology that has much less variables of delineation inside it, right? And can start focusing on data and, anyways, but
yeah, I mean, I love the idea, you know, what that guy did this morning and the idea of, you know, just it's my way or the highway. And like, you pay me to be the expert in security, so I'm going to help you. But at the end of the day, it is a business and you got to enable the business. And I want to share with you like an actual reality that happened and why it's very nuanced, right? So let me tell you, you're in healthcare, right? You've got different sites and everything. not all sites have the physicians who can provide like the expertise for the certain thing, specifically neurologists who can tell if a patient is suffering a stroke at that time. So what we end up doing, or solutions in modern medicine today, is they call it telestroke, right? It's like the precursor of telehealth. So you get on a FaceTime and you're talking to a neurologist and they're asking you questions, looking at your face or whatever, and they tell if you're a stroke. And for those who don't know, the faster you diagnose a stroke, it's substantially more important, like time. If you cut that internet to stop the C2 traffic, you also cut telestroke. And you may not know that the telestroke is even a service in your environment, right? Or introduce any kind of critical, you know, internet enabled service into your environment, and that now you have life impacting situations, right? So it's hard to make that call. That's why when I said in that morning, the morning thing where that guy in Florida cut the internet on his hospital, I said, that dude must have had some serious political capital. I guarantee you that guy worked there for a long time already, and he knows what's going on to be able to make that call.
But, yeah, I mean, not knowing what you're cutting off as a documentation process problem.
And that is a hearts and minds and critical infrastructure. Like, if you look at CIS, it's number one and two, right? It's know thyself. Exactly. Where are my critical assets?
They don't know what's getting cut off. I don't care about it.
No, but I think back to Gerald's point. So let's say now you're doing this telehealth and you're just dialing in over HTTPS, right? And you're just reaching out to this third-party service that held it themselves. They've got their SOC. It got approved by the security team. That's not going to be in the operational knowledge, to Gerald's point, of the person that's trying to figure that out. I think this is kind of part of that. Everybody has to be involved in security. Everybody has to be a part of this. When that telehealth service got approved, it had to go beyond this just technical, can we do it? And does it meet our security standards, to does this get added into our critical infrastructure list? Does this get tied into any operational? And you're right, that's documentation challenge, but it's not just documentation challenge. It's process flow. It's operational, having people either have the checklists or the hearts and minds behind getting that kind of information systematized. But yeah, it's just one example.
And, you know, and shout out and much love. Anytime I get a chance to give GRC love, I do it. And I mean, this is a GRC thing, right? The governance. What's the governance of that organization? Yeah. Can anyone stand up a service?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Speaking of GRC, there's one thing I wish I would see more than all of these little headlines, and that's a real postmortem on these incidents. Show me what failed. Show me the process that
failed. What control, if any, was in place that failed? Right? Yeah. Amen. I mean, and I think that does happen. You know, when I was at Iconic, we had incident review meetings, right? So we had our incidents, and then afterwards we would actually have a panel of people from other offices that weren't involved in that incident be involved in the review with them to learn what could we have learned here, boys and girls.
And who built that? I'm guessing it might have been you.
It may have been me. And actually, I don't know. Can I take the full credit? I don't want to be that guy.
Well, you're part of it.
I think I was half of it. Yeah, okay. In that case. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've always said it a long time ago, because even stuff that happened with Kaseya, that not everything has been publicly fully acknowledged, and there's a lot of these things that we never will, right? So it's going to be interesting to see what actually comes out. Did y'all see, and I kind of let everybody talk a little bit there, but I wanted to circle back to one thing that when the Ukrainian websites were compromised, did anybody else see that of all those sites, they were using the same CMS solution?
I saw Alan Liska over at Recorded posted that.
Yeah.
Oh,
I remember seeing it somewhere back then.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the timeline of this, though, because, you know, the biggest things before the Kaseya attack, they were quite prevalent already with ransomware from Soda Nukibi or R-Evil, right? They already had in 2019, you know, I was at least have firsthand knowledge of an MSP that was definitely compromised by that, through basically the old Kaseya stuff, right? Like some of the things that were going to come out later, were the initial supply chain. And so, If you look at the timeline up leading up to this arrest, you know, the feds actually stood on the stage in November, I think it was November 8th or so. And they said, hey, listen, we're going to go ahead and we put hands on these guys in the UAE, but we also have sanctions for the Kaseya attack, right? Cause they had a joint announcement of the SolarWinds and Kaseya, entities at the same time on that day. And you know, the Northern District of Texas, feds had a warrant for people in Russia. So, you know, that was November 8th. We're 3 months later. And so I think from a timing perspective, you would think that once those sealed affidavits happened and once those sealed things got over to Russia, they just decided today's the day, right? We're gonna go snag them now, right? We're gonna go raid these 25 people's entities' houses and yeah.
I think the ransomware operators, the Russian system is very dynamic. They can move on a dime, I think.
Oh, I would think so too.
Especially when they're,
especially if you stand up and say, "I hate Putin," it wouldn't take long.
You're just asking for it at that point. No one here is saying that, by the way. Even if they are, it's not me. I don't want to die of poisoning myself.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, one of the things that Eric mentioned right at the beginning was whether or not these are patsies. You know, basically,
that's the word for it. Perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, I would argue that, you know, time will tell, but because we're pretty good at attribution and not nation state attribution, but code attribution, like
certainly
this
code
is
attribution.
Reval. Yeah. This, yeah. You know, like they're not going to burn all of their tradecraft just to look different, right? They're going to use that same thing. So I think if we see this should cripple Reval, right? Like that's how it's being portrayed.
So
I think it will.
Well, I'm saying this is how it's being portrayed.
Come back as, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm more likely to think it's patsies if it rebrands because they didn't cut the head off the snake, right? But if they did that, I don't think we'd see as much of those TTPs specific to Reval.
You're also contemplating that those same people can't be operating out of a FSB bunker going forward.
Mm-hmm. True story.
Just because they were arrested doesn't mean they're off the board.
But I would think that would be stupid of Russia in the sense that, back to Gerald's point, we really are pretty good at code attribution. Like we really are pretty good.
How many people have that code?
TTPs and.
Well, that's not released right now. As far as I know, like Reval's code isn't, I mean, it's not out there. The source isn't out there the way some of these other ones are.
I've gotten to see the source firsthand a few times and that's very easy to see. Oh, you mean the source. Yeah, sorry.
I think what you need to understand is the fact that unless they got everyone, it's very easy for whoever was left out of that net, out of that dragnet, to continue operating or adapt.
Well, it depends on what
cubicle, as Eric and I say, because we think they all operate out of cubicles. Today they're going to be Reval, next week they're going to be Avedon, and they just choose which TTPs they want to use, and they, you know, go on the merry-go-round.
I don't know if they have that close of a relationship. I think it's a little.
We're just being facetious, but
I
do think that they collaborate a lot more than IT professionals do.
Yeah. And I mean, there is something to think about. You know, we said it before where, you know, Black Lives Matter is just rebranded and stuff like that. I do think that Reval will definitely come out either as themselves or somebody different. But there is rumor that the code that was, or the security tokens for the Onion site are still held, that there are people that are out there that still have it. So it may just be a matter of time before we start seeing those Onion sites pop back up or pop up as new URLs.
Matt, what are you seeing threat intel wise from your end? Cause you're on the vendor side. So I'm assuming you guys have a little deeper insight than what we're able to get as providers.
I'm actually not tactical, technical, operational inside our organizations for on purpose, right? I'm an educational resource external at this point, but I haven't seen much more than kind of what we've already talked about, in the sense that, you know, if I wanted to zoom out, what we're talking about is that the United States is kind of waking up. We're starting to see a little bit of movement on this, you know, talking about it and in the news and saying, hey, we caught these guys, we stopped the people that did this. And I think we're starting to get some pretty good arms in our judiciary as well from some of these things. But as far as what the threat intel is, I don't have anything more than you do. This particular Gerald probably would have better comments. It sounds like he's plugged in more to the TTPs. But
well, I mean, not so much on dynamic threat intel, but from a geopolitical perspective, if you look at the past couple years, you know, Russian-US relations have been cool and not super, you know, cooperative. So I just find it interesting that, you know, the U.S. has been pushing specifically around this threat actor group, and for Russia to intervene in some capacity. And for Russia to intervene, I'm not saying they're doing us a favor, but it just seems,
it's an olive branch.
Yeah, right? It just seems a little different than what they normally do in these type of situations. So it makes my mind immediately go to, like, why, right? Is there an actual sanction around some type of critical resource?
Need.
Yeah, like critical resource, like we talked before we went on, like oil or aluminum or,
you know,
something that isn't obvious. It's not just money and ransomware and trying to end this.
And it's not a big enough, you know, branch, I think, for an invasion, right? Like, it's not a big enough branch to say, hey, you're good with us now, we're going to invade Ukraine, right? Like, or it's just misweighted in its value to the U.S. But yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't know what's driving that directly.
Yeah, I do find it interesting, just from an academic perspective, that according to the international norms of what is defined as warfare,
the laws of armed conflict,
you know, all the countries that are, you know, developed get together and they all agree, it doesn't really allow for cyber, which is why what Russia's done to Ukraine over the last 5 years hasn't ever risen to the level where a country like the United States could take intervention on behalf of Ukraine, because we'd be committing the act of war there. But it's crystal clear, if they take those troops and move them in, that is much more of an act of war. But
I'm
not a scholar on it, because they did it in Crimea a few years ago and it didn't result in that. So, it's interesting how the acts of war don't come into scope when you're talking about these cyber, attacks, for lack of a better term.
I think with cyber, there's a lot more damage that could happen a lot faster with a lot less notification. Okay, moving troops, there's satellite imagery. You can foretell that. Someone launches a missile, you can foretell that. Yeah. Someone launches a cyber attack, you probably don't know until it's hit.
Yeah.
So no one wants to play chicken with that, so to speak. At least I don't think they do.
But I think, you know, I would certainly say, if I were Russia, I would lead with a cyber methodology to try to beat people into submission. You got to look at how Russia sees Ukraine. They're like their lost cousin, right? They're shitter's full, Clark, right? Like they love and hate and want them to be part of. They don't want it to be separate, right? At least as I kind of understand this, correct me if I'm wrong, but you got to have this vision of, we don't want to really go to war with them. We don't really want to go do, but we could take out their power, right? As you said, in 2014, some great point, but they can cause a lot of disruption. And I actually was, you know, our capabilities, right? I promise you, if we led with warfare, we would lead with a cyber attack, right? It's just only in our best interest to disrupt and to take away and dismantle the capabilities of our adversary. And so I think that, you know, Russia's been practicing this with Ukraine. Like, they've literally like been their test bed for the last 4 years. Like, they've just tested code and tested capabilities and tested the ability to take out power or mess with plants and operations or industrial control systems and things that allow them to really, really bring a country to its knees. And what's funny is I was talking about this with an unnamed individual that's a CEO of a pretty large cyber firm here. And he used to be NSA, and he said, yeah, we've had those capabilities to take out a country in 5 seconds.
I know who that is.
You probably do, but you know,
I like it.
We have the same capabilities, right?
Well,
it's from the same playbook.
Yeah. And you know, I'd like to point out an interesting element of, you know, cause we're kind of talking about two different things here. We're talking about Reval and we're talking about, you know, Russia-Ukraine thing. Another interesting element of this whole Russia-Ukraine thing over the weekend was that they used website defacement as kind of the very overt, the very splashy thing to kind of distract from what was actually happening. But I would argue that if you talk to a normal, a general citizen who doesn't actually understand technology, right, and you said, Department of Treasury was ransomwared, that doesn't really resonate. But if you bring up the website and there is a, you know, scary message, like, people can wrap their head around what a website is and the fact that the website that they expect is no longer there. It, like, I don't want to call it terror, but it has a much more profound emotional impact on the citizens of Ukraine than just saying they got ransomware, because there's an abstraction for non-technical people to really appreciate what that means.
Well, that's a hearts and minds thing, right? And the Russians have been very good at playing on those heartstrings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, great point though, Gerald. It's funny because the corollaries to the reason we can't get people to move on cyber and can't get people to move on hardening their technology and investing in change towards things that are more secure is the exact same thing. How can we get people to, oh, you know what? We'll take down their website. We'll deface something they're going to see that they will notice. We'll take this. That's a funny corollary, right? In the sense that that's the same challenge of why we can't get people to defend themselves. The threat actors are having to come up with their own ways to overcome, right? It's fantastic.
Yeah.
We have Ken Edwards here, and he was asking, has anyone actually validated that the packets are in fact coming from Russia or not a third party country?
Yeah, typically when any of the very, very smart people, CrowdStrike, Mandiant, FireEye, a lot of the reverse malware engineers actually go through and, you know, start looking at the TTPs for said ransomware, set malware, CrowdStrike or whatever, they do pull those logs from the firewall, especially in their sandbox, and to see where is this beaconing to? Are those IPs actually registered to, you know, a known VPN server like ExpressVPN or HideMyIP or whatever, or is it actually to a real legitimate ISP, things of that nature? So now there is a lot of back-end homework and threat analysis that goes
to his point, you know, and to just kind of abstract this back to the question is, yeah, attribution is kind of hard, right? Especially when you really get down into who's pulling the strings, it gets really rough. Depending on a mistake where it leaks a C2 server that was part of their protected side, or the code when deobfuscated has something in it that gives them a little bit of attribution aside from the actual delivery arm that's trying to get through firewalls. But yeah, short story is attribution comma space equals hard. I think Chris Roberts put it the best. He's like, so we're going to send a missile for the threat actors and it's going to go in grandma's bedroom window, right?
Like, yeah.
Ultimately.
Pretty much.
But yeah, attribution's an art, I would wager.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying, you know, okay, you're doing a reverse lookup on someone who's hammering a port scan on your thing, but it comes back as Comcast.
Right.
You know? Yeah, we can confirm it's a U.S.
That Nighthawk router you've got at home that now has 500 vulnerabilities is a great launch pad for my next attack, right? Like,
but yeah, to Ken's question, yeah, there are people who do it, but you know, we can't get very granular on where exactly the stuff is without cooperation from third party entities that are may or may not have the interest to actually help us.
Yeah, this is calls back to NotPetya. Good quote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I wanted to
not as broad of a scale. It seems very targeted. Back to
well, you'd almost think that they did a post mortem of NotPetya and were like, hey, we should really be better about focusing this.
So true.
What I find interesting is that it's supposedly fake ransomware, even though Microsoft and some of the other.
Well, it's an MBR wipe, and then it comes back with file modifications up to the first meg. So yeah, it's pretty rough.
Has anybody looked at the Bitcoin address that was publicized or put on
like
there?
Dug into it? I haven't.
Dude, was it yours? There's been payments been made to that Bitcoin address.
Oh no, that's
I'm like,
you know how much?
Because they're
curious.
I'll have to look it up again. I don't remember, but it's a little bit under one Bitcoin. So I would say about $30,000-$40,000 right now.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to lose any, but that's at least a little less painful.
Sure. But I don't think there's a path to perdition, right? Like or path from perdition on this, right? I think once those files are modified, it's just a fake ransomware, right? It's just destruction.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I almost wonder if like, you know, my first thought is like, oh, not misattribution, but it's guile in order to like make people run down that path. But now I'm thinking, I wonder if it was ransomware and they just like, because it's easier
messed
to just
up.
Gut out pieces of code and comment it out.
Right.
Just building a new tool. So and I almost wonder if it was ransomware before it got, you know, gutted at some point.
I think it was a proof of concept.
Yeah.
How bad we can mess this up going forward.
Well, I laugh at myself, right? I was telling you guys earlier, I was doing a FUF command and I was pulling from an empty file and wondering why I got no results. It was an empty file and they didn't write anything to it the first time. So yeah, people make mistakes, I promise you.
Great.
That's funny. Yeah, they just carved it out. They never did any of the encryption engine or anything. They just modified bits and stored nothing and moved on. Like, is that kind of the thought process, broken code?
It's still access though. And that's the scary part, right? They were still able to get in.
Well, and it did its job, right? I think if I recall, the methodologies was very effective at taking off systems, right?
Yeah.
MBR equals no boot. So.
Yeah. It's kind of like my laptop that's sitting over here right now. No boot.
No boot.
Poor Razer going back to Lenovo. Anyway.
Oh, that's not good.
That's pretty much it for me, guys. You guys have anything else you wanted to cover?
No, I think it's pretty much the only statement I'd make going forward is if Russia does start putting that kind of pressure and keeps their best closer with the people they are using for their own state needs, you'll probably see more Russian code show up with some of the Chinese. You're starting to see a lot of third-party proxying from the Chinese, trying to use these resources and use other countries' resources to do their bidding, kind of part of their overall strategy, right? So I would wager you'll start seeing some of these former actors in certain entities start showing up as Chinese actors.
Well, there was an article, and I forgot where I saw this, but it specifically stated that Chinese APTs and Russian APTs have been collaborating in the recent months.
Fair. That would stand to reason.
If that's the case, God help us all.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's some hope, though. Nice. I think there's some hope, though, right? I think as we talk about this more, as this becomes more politicized in some ways, which sucks, but as we start seeing cyber get talked about, we have to come up with failed attempts that really suck and then get better. And we're going to get better as a country and as a global citizenry at understanding privacy implications, at understanding security implications and technology implications. So I do think, though, this is awakening kind of a giant. I mean, look at what the State Department's been able to do from crypto coin seizures and reaching out, right? Like, we're starting to make it tough to do what they're doing. And so I think we're going to be get better.
Well, Alan Lisko is the first person I heard say this, but you just have to make it more expensive for them. Raise the cost for these guys to do business, meaning ransomware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like back to the Industrial Revolution, though, we didn't have building codes. Buildings fell in on people and they died. We didn't have fire escapes.
Still doesn't.
We made fire escapes, right? We had locks on doors. We now have push bars. I think we're talking about a compressed and condensed, fast-changing environment, cyber and technology, that moved faster than any regulatory and understanding level could ever catch up. And now we're paying that tax, right? Like, I think so.
I certainly hope, big government, it moves slow, but I have hope, I guess maybe I'm
right. I'm just in this hope phase.
Yeah. If you look at what Jen Easterly's doing at CISA, I hope that is indicative of a new kind of regime or a new philosophy that's entering into the upper echelons of federal government and the ability to adapt and overcome and be agile, yeah, and really be responding to the actual threats instead of, a 3-year cycle of documentation update and governance. It's just the old way doesn't scale to our new threats. So yes, thank you. Thank you, Matt. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about real quick, it just popped in my head. It's pure speculation, but it makes for a juicy beer conversation.
Hold my beer.
Yeah. Like, we talk about, like, historically, it doesn't happen nearly as often anymore, but historically, Kevin Mitnick, Kevin Paulson, these individuals who were really good and were identified, got arrested, and then they became basically
educators,
resources for the government, right? Until they went off and did their own thing. Like, I'm just thinking to Shiv's point earlier, like, these people, maybe the money was too good for them to want to go take a civilian job at FSB because, money talks, right? So here, let's make the decision easy for you. You can have freedom and a job with us, or you can have the alternative. So that might actually be part of it where, here's a sweetheart deal. Would you like to have a cool job, infinite resources, and work for us, or, go to jail? So, yeah. See.
You also have to look at it that culturally, Russia is incredibly different from that of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So what motivates those people there is a lot different. And to me, I see ransomware as two things here in the United States. It's a way to make us suffer. And the Russian people, I hate to say this, were born into suffering, and they can suffer better than most. Mm. And I also look at ransomware as a mapping exercise here in the United States to really enumerate what our capabilities are in the bigger picture. So if they do have to go to war on that front, they have their playbooks established.
Yeah. I mean, well, I was thinking that's what SolarWinds was until Carl, the intern over there, like decided to take FireEye's tool set. Like if they hadn't done that, I really feel like it would have been, they could have gone, they could have slept like quietly in the SolarWinds.
Oh yeah. I'm with you on that one. What if we had never heard anything about it? It was something I'd proposed, right? If we had never heard about SolarWinds, how much more infrastructure would be impacted? So
I have a thought for you there. What if they allowed FireEye to know what they were doing, the version, they can work in other places?
We had that discussion too. It's like, yeah, let's just see what happens when we press this button.
Yeah. If the fire is here, what are we doing over here?
Sting. That's funny, Keith. Well, but hey, boys, we're showing up. We're going to give you a free ride to the new job. I digress. All right, I'm out. Thanks, boys, for inviting me on. And Gerald, nice to meet you, man. I love meeting other pundits in the cybersecurity space that know more than me. So always makes me happy.
I think it takes a village, Matt. So it was definitely fair. Nice to meet you as well. And I'll connect with you and we can continue the conversations.
Maybe we'll have you on a beard banner one of these days. I'm starting up my little podcast thing.
So. All right. Actually, I'll promote it.
To be on it.
A lot of people haven't had beards at all. Like it's been even fuzz. Like I'm going to get a fake beard. I can get drop shipped to my patrons or to people that come on the show that don't have a beard. Like it's just a.
Ladies and gentlemen and ghouls that are out there on the internet, if you have made it this far, thank you so much for tuning in for yet another episode of AmplifiedAndIntensified.com. You know what? A recent change to the platform. Shiva has put together a new website, AmplifiedAndIntensified.com. If you have heard anything that you have liked about this podcast and you want to engage Shiva or myself or be able to help sponsor by donating us some coffee, all the links of our calendars, buying us coffee, past episodes of both the podcast and the YouTube version are all now on AmplifiedAndIntensified.com. Go there for all of your needs. Thank you so much. And until next time, take care.